Hey folks, a quick note before we get started. As I told you last week, Stay Tuned with Preet has been nominated for a People's Voice Webby Award for Best Episode of a News and Politics Podcast. The episode features my conversation with Dan Goldman, who offered us his first interview after serving as lead House Majority Counsel during the first impeachment of President Trump. We're neck and neck with some very formidable fellow nominees and need your help to pull off another Webby's victory. So head to vote.webbyawards.com and search for Stay Tuned or Preet to cast your ballot. You can also find a direct voting link in the show notes of this episode. Today, Thursday, May 6th, is the last day to vote. Thanks, as always, for your support. From CAFE and the Vox Media Podcast Network, this is Stay Tuned. I'm Preet Bharara.
You know, having spent almost six decades as an African-American man, you know, seeing this, I was just breathtakingly stunned in the outrageousness of it.
This is somebody's life. This isn't a victory in that sense. It's an acknowledgement of the truth of what happened, but it's not a cause for celebration.
That's Jerry Blackwell and Steve Slisher. They're the two men who led the prosecution of Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer convicted of murdering George Floyd. Blackwell and Slisher are both private attorneys. In July of last year, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison asked each of them to join the prosecution team they had never met. Blackwell, an accomplished civil litigator who had never tried a criminal case, ended up giving the opening statement. And Slisher, who served for 13 years as a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in St. Paul, gave the closing argument. Today, the pair join me for the longest and most in-depth interview they've given since the trial. We talk about the trial's big moments and key decision points, but we also discuss what the verdict meant for these two men personally and for the cause of racial justice in this country. I found the conversation both powerful and deeply revealing. So this week, we're doing something a little different. Instead of taking your questions, we're going straight to my full interview with the team that secured the conviction of Derek Chauvin. That's coming up. Stay tuned. Jerry Blackwell and Steve Slisher, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's a real honor and treat to have you, given how much you have done for the country and for the justice system. I want to thank you for your service, which, by the way, I don't know if everyone knows this. Each of you is in private practice, and you performed your services at the Derek Chauvin trial for free, as we say, pro bono. So thank you for that as well.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I've got a lot to ask you about the trial, the nature of the trial, strategy of the trial, the meaning of the trial. So let's get through as much as we can. And I almost wasn't sure where to start. And I thought, well, why don't I start at the beginning, which is not the trial, which is not the opening statements, but the actual killing of George Floyd himself last May, May of 2020. Both of you are in private practice, had no idea that you would become involved in that case in any way, probably had no idea if there would ever be a criminal case against anyone. Do you recall how you reacted to the murder itself? What reaction you had when you saw the videotape when you were still just private citizens?
I do remember that reaction. Having spent over two decades as a prosecutor, law enforcement is something that, you know, I have a keen interest in, a lot of friends in law enforcement, and a real love for law enforcement officers. And I remember looking at that and seeing it and not recognizing it at all as something that should be coming from a law enforcement officer. And it would really just hit you right straight in the stomach, right straight in the heart. And I remember, you know, after seeing it, knowing that I would probably be called in my firm. I'm in a relatively small firm, about 80 lawyers. I would be called to sort of contextualize the events because there's not anybody else in my firm that has the same exact background as me, you know, spending that much time as a prosecutor. And so I spent a lot of time over the next few days talking to, different partners, associates, staff members, just about what had happened and helping our firm, you know, kind of process it because it really was wrenching to everybody.
And Jerry?
You know, having spent almost six decades as an African-American man, you know, seeing this, I was just breathtakingly stunned in the outrageousness of it. You know, what exactly could equal protection mean, or what is the rule of law if there isn't some accountability for that? And at the same time, there was this kind of uncertainty in your stomach that nothing may come of this at all, because we've been at this intersection before of, to me, outrageous misconduct imposed upon, you know, Black people, brown people, colored people, because of the mutable characteristic, and quite often the rule of law itself has protected that. And so my initial gut reaction was the sense of outrage, the sense that that's an earthquake, and what's coming next is a giant tsunami in public reaction. And, you know, I do a lot of work for Fortune 500, 100 companies, and I'm one of the few people, some of them know that they would categorize us in quotes woke for the white in-house counsel. So I expected I might hear from a number of them just with their reactions, what my thoughts might be. And sure enough, I did hear from a number of them, two of them in tears when they call. And one of the statements I was told was, it was so shocking to me as a white person, because I don't believe that ever would have happened to me as a white person. And there it is in my face. And they were simply shocked and stunned by it. So it was just the sense of the shock and the outrage of the whole thing, and the apparent callousness of the police officers involved was just stunning.
You know, Jerry, I hadn't heard him say that before, and I remember having that reaction too when I was watching it, thinking to myself, and then hearing, you know, what the whole call was about, suspected counterfeit $20 bill.
Right.
I remember thinking to myself, well, that would not have happened to me. It just, they would have assumed it was a mistake. They would have asked me about it. And if it became apparent that it wasn't a mistake, they probably would have given me a ticket.
Written you a ticket.
And gone on my way. And so I do remember thinking that as well.
Did you, Steve, given your experience as a former prosecutor, aside from being horrified by what you saw, did you form a view as to whether or not this was a prosecutable criminal case against one or more officers at that time?
You know, I certainly did believe that that was going to be a prosecutable case against, you know, Chauvin.
You've forgotten his name already.
Well, I know I was caught mispronouncing it several times during the trial between Chauvin and Chauvin. The first time I heard it, I think someone said Chauvin, and so it was hard for me to switch. But yeah, no, I remember thinking to myself that, you know, that looked like excessive force just on the face of it, based on his, you know, the placement of his knee on George Floyd's neck. But, you know, I also had a healthy sense of reality in that, you know, I think that the track record is pretty clear in terms of how many officers are prosecuted for offenses like this, and then how many are ultimately convicted. I don't think that I really questioned whether or not charges would be brought. I was questioning at what level, and then, but always wondering if the officers involved would ultimately be convicted, because it's just very difficult for people to accept that a police officer would have done something intentionally wrong. We tend to try to think of any reason that could be a possible rational explanation for what it is that we're seeing that looks so plainly wrong. But we're wired to believe the police, from a very young age.
At least we, meaning white America, not mm-hmm. not Black or brown America, mm-hmm. that have different experiences since childhood.
You know, and perhaps that's so, Jerry, but also let's not forget how many people of color called the police on the police when they saw this horrible thing happen. I mean, I think that no matter what your mistrust is, there still is something that makes you reach out. Even George Floyd believed the police would help him.
Sure, but I'm simply saying there isn't this sort of, you know, reticence or wholesale endorsement or disbelief in the idea that the police could ever do this.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, my most nervous moments as a citizen simply minding my own business is driving on the street and noticing that there is a police car behind me. And I couldn't remember really a time in my life where there was a police car behind me where I felt more comfortable, where I felt safer, where I did not feel at risk. And if you're not going to be hurt, then you're certainly going to be harassed. You're going to be stopped for no reason. And in all likelihood, there will be some callous person who gets out of a car and who just gratuitously speaks to you in a nasty way for no reason. And all of which you just like just to avoid. And so that's what, for me, as an African-American lawyer, even, protect to serve has meant. That's what it's translated into. And I had very few experiences to the contrary when I just randomly encountered police, no matter where I've been in the country.
And I've literally never had the experience of being pulled over for no reason based on the color of my skin, right? So that's an experience that, you know, you can describe it to me, but I don't really get it. Like, I understand what you're saying, but it doesn't have the same meaning to me as someone who's experienced it.
Jerry, that experience that you've had many, many times in your life, did that play some role in your agreement to get involved in the prosecution of this case coming out of private practice?
Certainly, yes. I mean, it meant I had a personal connection with the inhumanity of it, with the objectification of people by the police that way. And for me, it's a form of random violence even. You don't know this person, this individual. They haven't really done anything that's unlawful. You simply have targeted them for negative aggression because of an immutable characteristic they have and the fact that you have a badge that gives you cover to do it. And I've experienced it many times in my life, and sometimes as a lawyer, leaving my office with my briefcase and white collar on, and still, you know, harassed in various ways by the police who stop me for no reason, or they are pulled behind my car when I come out of my building, and I stop and look to say, is there something wrong? They point, get in your car, just point to get in your car, and I drive away in a block, then they put the light on anyway, and then pull you over, and I get a lecture about being 3 feet from the curb, and I could write you a ticket and all kinds of other things that were said to provoke, actually. And I just didn't take the bait, because taking it would have meant they would have justified it in escalating things. So that definitely played a role for me, that George Floyd, for so many Black and brown people, was in a way emblematic. And I'm not talking about the drug addiction and so on, but just that kind of harsh, callous treatment is something we can all relate to because we've all experienced it in degrees. And we know what that looks like and what that feels like. And the fact that quite often it goes without any redress whatsoever under the law. It's just an injury that you just have to live with because there's nothing that you can do. And you have to then go before juries quite often where the majority of people find the whole experience foreign to them. And that's
because
quite
a steep burden. Happened to them.
It's never happened to them. And it may be their uncles, sons, brothers, fathers, and so on who behave this way. But I know things about, apparently, their own people they don't know in terms of how they behave.
Well, that's why these videotapes, not just in the George Floyd case, but in all these other cases are important because people who have not experienced this kind of thing are now witnessing those things on videotape. And as you said at the trial, they can believe their own eyes, right?
That's right. If you wonder, just watch this. And the trial was, you'll talk more about it in detail in a second, but even in the opening statement, I mean, I was intentionally subdued and factual in the presentation in the opening because I thought the video spoke so much for itself by itself, and it didn't need any contribution from me with respect to vitriol or anything added to it. So I simply wanted to basically tee it up and let the jurors see for themselves and experience for themselves. And for those who wouldn't otherwise believe, seeing is believing.
You raise this issue of treatment of the hands of the cops. Now you are well known, your face is well known, your name is well known, and you have successfully prosecuted a police officer. Have you had any interactions with police since the trial? Anything notable?
We both have obviously many interactions with the police who are all around the courthouse, the various sheriffs and other officers who are at the courthouse all the time. And I will tell you, and maybe Steve will speak to this too, but it was overwhelmingly positive. And I can't really tell you how many police officers who were there came up to say thank you for doing this, that when these kinds of things happen, it reflects badly on the rest of us. And we had police officers come up and say that. Now, driving around in the Twin Cities, I haven't had any encounter with the police, and I have to say I'm grateful for that because no idea what I might encounter still.
I want to get into the details of the trial in a second, but first let's talk about, for a moment, how you both wound up on the trial team. At some point, the case did not proceed under the local district attorney's office supervision. It was transferred to the attorney general's office in Minnesota and was under the supervision of the attorney general of the state, Keith Ellison. And each of you was contacted by Keith Ellison. Neither of you, I believe, really knew him. I think one of you had never met him at all, never spoken to him.
Yeah, that was me. I'd never met Attorney General Ellison before, never spoken with him. And, you know,
do you think it was the wrong number?
Known him for a while. You know, I did.
Were you surprised by the call?
I was surprised by the call. And in fact, I saw there was a, you know, I'm working at home. You know, this is all in the context of the COVID pandemic as well. Yeah. You know, and so you have all of those different things that happen. I saw that I had a missed call on my phone, and I just missed it. And so I hit redial, and it was the attorney general. And I could recognize his voice. And he identified, he said, this is Keith Ellison. And I kind of laughed because I didn't think that it really was. I thought somebody might be, you know, playing a joke on me. But then it became clear it really was him. And he called me and reached out because he was wondering if I would be able to help him out with this case. And I just remember thinking to myself, you know, as you know, you're a prosecutor. That's at some point in your career as a prosecutor, if you go down that path, you stop thinking of yourself as a lawyer and you think of yourself as a prosecutor. I left that office, you know, in 2017, January 2017. So when I get this call asking to help with this case, it stirred up a lot of feelings in me in terms of what I love doing so much. I love being a prosecutor. It's a very big part of my identity. And he asked if I could help with a case. And of course, my initial reaction was, well, yes, I would love to do that. Yeah, absolutely. I'd seen the video. I knew that the state was in a significant amount of pain. The city, the state, the whole country was in pain. And just as a prosecutor, you find yourself in that position where you need to walk with someone who is going through pain and trauma, whether it's a family of a murder victim or you know, sexual assault, any sort of crime. And so that was my instinct. Of course, I had to call my partners and ask them if that was something that I could do. And, you know, they were very receptive and very supportive of the effort. The firm that I belonged to was kind of born of some anti-Semitism, some smart attorneys who had gone to Harvard and came back to Minnesota, back to Minneapolis at a time in the late 40s, anti-Semitism was high and they couldn't get hired. Right. And so they started their own firm, and they always had this culture of allowing lawyers to follow their conscience. One of our founders was in the Nuremberg trials, was a prosecutor. You know, they supported attorneys who've been in the supported the ACLU and whatnot. And so they're very supportive of that. I was just so grateful that they would do that.
Did you think it was odd at all that given the resources of the state and the number of assistant attorneys general that there must be in that office, that they would go outside the office to find people to try the case?
You know, I think I was aware that, you know, because remember, I came from that office. That I worked at the attorney general's office from 2000 to 2003 at a time when they had a fairly robust criminal trial division, you know, doing a lot of cases, you know, all over the state. We have 87 counties in Minnesota, a 7-county metro area. They handle a lot of their own, you know, complex prosecutions and homicides, but the AG's office did a lot of the outstate stuff. But, you know, during the period of time when I was at the U.S. Attorney's office, there was some attrition in the office that wasn't replaced. I think there was more of an emphasis on, you know, consumer protection and whatnot. And so I didn't think that the criminal trial division was actually that large at the AG's office. And so I could see where they would want to get some people to help support the case. I think I thought, and Jerry thought, I'll let him speak for himself, that we would be more on a consulting basis. Just I'd had some experience, you know, prosecuting a civil rights case before and certainly had a lot of prosecution experience. I thought that I'd be, you know, working more in that capacity.
Mm-hmm. And then Jerry, with respect to you, this is stunning to people who are in this business. not only were you not a former prosecutor, you were not even a criminal defense lawyer. And it's unusual for people to have the kind of trust, faith, and confidence in you that Keith Ellison clearly had. And I wonder, as I heard you speak earlier in the conversation, whether in some way you think that not having that prosecutorial background and not having had the experience of working shoulder to shoulder with law enforcement, including with police departments and police officers, was that somehow an advantage to you?
It wasn't, in a sense. It was an advantage. It was, for me, both a strength and what no doubt made me supremely frightening to a number of people.
I mean, you're clearly an accomplished trial lawyer, and I should say, I haven't said this yet, you two and the rest of the team did an outstanding job. I noted that multiple times on social media. But when I learned, and it took me a while to learn, that you had not tried a criminal case, I will tell you that I was shocked.
Right, right. I agree with Steve that we initially thought that we would be essentially behind the scenes, maybe helping with strategy or approach the witness or witness prep or that sort of thing. I think that General Ellison called me because I do try cases, and I've had to try hard cases in tough jurisdictions, mostly outside of Minnesota. I've been in various parts of Mississippi and in Oakland, in Madison County, Illinois, and I've had to go in there. For Fortune 500 companies, Fortune 100 companies, they quite often have difficult stories to tell as defendants. I mean, you have tough histories to deal with, tough witnesses, tough documents, and you have to figure out in every case strategically how to win with that. And I've had quite a bit of success by the grace of the Lord doing it. And I think he felt that some of that might be useful to this team. But again, I thought it would be more or less in a support kind of role function, and it evolved to be something other than that. I've always said, as a trial lawyer, I think with the right kind of support, you can really try any kind of case, because there's no such thing as a criminal jury and a civil jury. A jury is a jury, and if you have a narrative, if you thought through the strategy, if you know the law, and if you don't manage to mess it up such that you can't keep your verdict when it goes up on appeal, you know, you'll be all right. So it was kind of the first foray, and believe you me, as I describe myself as a freshwater alligator in a saltwater crocodile pond.
I will tell you that metaphor is a little bit lost on a New Yorker like me, but it's very colorful. I don't know a lot about, I don't even know the difference between an alligator and a crocodile.
Well, we don't have any of them in Minnesota. We just have mosquitoes. So I was stepping gingerly, most of the time here to make sure I wasn't running afoul of something that's a tripwire specific to criminal law. Since there's no such thing as Brady or Giglio in my civil world, right, for starters, and I had to deal with this. What? You mean we're going to give them that? Are you kidding?
What are you talking about?
Yes, Jerry, we are going to give them that. We're on a silver platter.
Right.
But, you know, I would say just in those initial conversations and describing the case, it would be impossible to listen to Jerry describe the case and not think that he should have a significant stand-up role in the trial. I felt that right away. And apparently so did Attorney General Ellison. Just as we progressed in and evolved in our various groups, talking about the different parts of the case that we were trying to help with, I just think the roles sort of emerged.
Jerry, can I ask you, did anything about this experience cause you, at least for a moment, to regret that you had never spent time as a prosecutor?
Now, that's quite a question. A great deal.
Well, you're very good at it, and you accomplished something important. And so I wonder if you've thought about that.
No, I didn't think I'd made a wrong life choice. I did think, because this is the first time in my life professionally where it made just eminently good sense to me to jump first, to leap first, and then worry about the landing second. And after I jumped out here into this, it dawned on me once I committed to it, wait a minute. You've never done a criminal case in your life. Right. You could end up as a quote on a T-shirt. This could be the end of whatever.
Something about alligators. About a dead alligator.
right. And whatever traction you'd gained as a civil practitioner may be lost too, and reputation ruined. So in that sense, I certainly wished that I had the kind of criminal experience that Steve has or had. But at the same time, this is an issue. It was not just a case. It was a cause. And for me, it was worth laying it on the line with whatever I had and just to put it all up. And hopefully the good guys win, justice prevails. And if not, there go I. And so I just set that all aside and sort of my worries about how I might be impacted. But I didn't think that I had kind of missed my calling and that I should have been a prosecutor, even in the civil world. I'm happy taking on a plaintiff's case, although I do mostly defense work. You know, I'm always sort of guided by what's the truthful position that I can take a stand on, whether I'm defending it or prosecuting it. It feels the same to me.
Right. Do you guys write a lot of notes to each other during the trial? It was hard to see depending on the camera angle. But do you each do your own thing, or are you communicating with each other and the rest of the team during the trial on a regular basis?
You know, that was hard because of COVID. There were some limitations. We really weren't able to.
We had rules that we weren't supposed to.
Rules?
Be. Yes.
There were rules.
There were rules in the
courtroom
that we were not supposed to be passing notes.
Yeah. Oh, why?
It was
because of COVID.
It was because of COVID, yeah. They had all this plexiglass up and all this other stuff. And, you know, of course, you find ways to communicate. But, you know, we've spent so much time together, I'd say, over the last 9 months.
And, you learned telepathy.
You know, a little bit, right? I mean, you've been in situations where you—
You guys are far more impressive than I even realized.
Well, tell your friends.
I'm in awe.
You know, we had a very structured communication chain. And we, you know, we had meetings that took place at prescribed times, you know, afterwards. And Keith Ellison kept us very much, you know, there was definitely a chain of information flow such that there weren't, you know, we weren't up there winging it.
Right.
You know, we had a plan. And, you know, going
well,
into court
clearly
was
did.
Executing the plan.
So the question, it's a broad question I want to ask that is not about the evidence. I don't know if you have a theory on this. I've always thought that every trial, civil probably also, my experience is in criminal, that you have to have a theme or, you know, one or two related themes of the case. Why? It's not required as a part of your proof. They don't make up the elements of the case, but there have to be themes and there also have to be sort of thoughts about what the case is not about. And I noticed as you tried the case and the evidence came in, your team was very clear on what the case was not about. And was fairly clear on what the case was about, although some things were omitted, and I'll get to those in a moment. But did you think about this case, not just in terms of what the building blocks of evidence were, but what the theme of the case was?
Absolutely. I mean, and in fact, I think that in terms of, you know, our first meetings, from our very first meeting, that was really Jerry's lane was, as a trial lawyer, And of course, I certainly did the same thing as a prosecutor. But you do need to pick a theme. You need to be able to give jurors just a way of thinking about the facts and the evidence because it's a compelling story. It's real. It's heartbreaking. It's tragic. But it's important that you're able to touch the jurors in a way that they're going to be able to remember the evidence and the facts that you present to them. But, you know, we did spend a lot of time talking about our themes and developing our themes. And in one of those first meetings, you know, Jerry said the words that, you know, you can believe your eyes. And of course, that was probably the most important theme.
But what's the theme there, Jerry? Is it common sense?
It is. It's a common sense theme. And it is also its own nature of a theme that sort of deflects the efforts to have the jurors look away from what they've seen to listen to some lawyer telling them the lawyer's version of what they've seen, and you don't need lawyer speak, lawyer spin, any of it. You can believe what you have seen for yourself, and it was to get the jurors back to the video because I felt any ordinary human being would see that and would have a good sense of what they had just seen, which is essentially a man dying one breath at a time with a callous officer on top of him. And I fully expected that the defense would be doing everything they can to have the jurors look away from the video and to substitute instead lawyer argument and testimony. And I want to bring it back to believe your eyes. Believe your eyes, it's homicide, it's murder.
You know, here's something that I think is difficult maybe for some folks to understand as we talk about theme. And as we talk about what this case is really about, both in the courtroom and for the wider broader country at large. We began this conversation talking about interactions between Black citizens and white police officers. And that's clearly how millions of Americans have been talking about this case that you two gentlemen tried. And for the country, given the protests and the videotape and the larger problem of criminal justice reform and policing and the treatment of Black and brown people in this country by law enforcement, in too many cases, that's what the country has been roiled up about. That's been what has galvanized so many people. That's what's getting senators and the President of the United States to talk about the issue. Racial justice, that was not a theme at the trial. And I understand why. But could each of you address the disconnect between how the whole world saw this case and the racial implications of it and underpinnings of it, but how that didn't make any showing at the trial?
Sure. I mean, as you know, when you're trying a criminal case, there are elements you need to prove, right? And we were very cognizant of the fact that the world was watching. The world's talking about our case, right? They have opinions. Those opinions were shared very generously with us during the trial. They'd email things that they think we should bring out or whatnot. But the fact of the matter is that we weren't trying the case to the world. We were trying the case to 12 people. We're trying the case to a jury. And we knew that, you know, at the end of the trial, the world isn't going to be in the deliberation room with them. All that's going to be there is their collective memories of the evidence, the exhibits that we marked and entered into evidence, and those jury instructions, which are going to lay out all of the elements that they have to find. And just in my experience trying cases, especially criminal cases, jurors take that very seriously. They do not take those responsibilities lightly, and they pore over that stuff. And so, you know, we could talk about those issues of racial justice and inequity. Then there's certainly a place for that. But that place is not in a criminal trial. In a criminal trial, what we need to talk about is the evidence, and we need to prove that case. And maybe that case becomes a springboard for some of those important issues to be discussed.
And here, in a bigger context, I was very conscious and aware that politically, we have a deeply polarized country, along racial lines. And if we allowed the trial to become a referendum on any of these various political camps' views, Blue Lives Matters, Black Lives Matters, and with a standard like reasonable doubt, I mean, we're toast. Because if the jurors, any of them, get fixed in their mind that this case is a referendum on some deeply held political point of view that they have, then they won't get off of that. And you only need one to lose. And so we had to really steer the case away from the shoals of these deeply held sort of political views that jurors might have so that it can be tried just on the basis of the facts as relate to Mr. Chauvin and not fall into these sort of, you know, ditches of political perspectives, which I thought was fraught with peril for the prosecution if we allowed that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. Although endlessly fascinating, because what you have on the videotape is a white man's knee in the back of the neck of a Black man, killing him slowly over 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And you came onto the case in part because of your feelings in part about racial justice. This case was about that to a large degree. But to get some form of justice and a first step towards ultimate racial justice, you had to stay away from that. Do you find that ironic at all?
Well, in a way, Preet, but on the other hand, it wasn't just Mr. Chauvin in the minds of the public that was on trial. It was the criminal justice system on trial.
Yeah.
And the public was on the edge of the chair. We can see what Mr. Chauvin did. But is where will the accountability come from in the criminal justice system? And that is where I think the public was looking, having sat through here in Minnesota, Philando Castile or Jamar Clark, fresh in the mind still, Rodney King, where seeing is not even necessarily believing, depending on who's on the jury. So to me, the jury was out on whether this criminal justice system would actually do justice in this instance. And that's really where I think the public was focused.
And you both also made it a point, and Steve, you especially, in your closing argument, to say what the case was not about. And I understand this was highly strategic as well. You said, and I'm quoting, quote, "This is not an anti-police prosecution. It's a pro-police prosecution. Make no mistake, this is not a prosecution of the police," end quote. How important was that theme and that point, do you think, to the trial?
I think it was essential. I mean, you think about this, Preet, what is the standard that we use to judge a police officer's conduct? What would a reasonable police officer do under similar circumstances? If this is a trial against the police generally, then that means none of them are reasonable, and all of them then would have engaged in this similar conduct, and we lose, right? I mean, if that is the standard, what would a reasonable police officer, not a reasonable bystander, not a reasonable member of the public, but a reasonable police officer do? Then we have to embrace reasonable police officers. And we had a number of reasonable police officers come forward and testify at the trial, including our chief of police.
Once there was no longer any resistance, and clearly when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
Did you have that many officers testify for that reason, or did you actually need all those officers to testify to everything that they testified to?
We needed every single one of those officers to testify to what they testified to, same with the number of bystanders, same with everything, because, you know, all you have to do is look at the win-loss record in terms of the prosecution of police to understand that there's no such thing as a slam dunk case. And under-resource the cases at your peril. Don't take anything for granted. Don't take any person for granted. Don't take any juror for granted.
Sure.
You know, none of it.
Do you ever get criticized? We got this criticism sometimes in SDNY. And I don't know, Jerry or Steve, if you've ever heard this. There's some judges who will say, stop over-trying your case. And I never really understood that. What I guess the judge means is, too much already. You have an overabundance of proof. Have you heard that? And did you have any worry that people thought that's what was going on here?
Of course. I mean, we heard words tantamount to that, you've got enough. How many experts do you need? You know, that sort of thing. But given how hard it is to convict a police officer, I liken it to leaping over a chasm. How fast do you need to run? Well, as fast as you can and hard as you can. You know? and you don't want to kind of in your moderation kind of miss the mark. And so how do you calculate, modulate, how much is enough? We just knew how important it was to have police officers speak to proper policing for jurors. And from as many different angles as were relevant, whether it is from the police training point of view, from the first aid training they received, any number of different perspectives on policing that we thought were implicated by the facts and that jurors needed to know about from the police, about the police.
That's right. And in terms of, you know, criticism, I guess I've always been willing to accept criticism. If the worst thing you can say about me or our team is that we put too much into it, that's great criticism. I love that criticism.
You can
it all day long. If what we did, however, was to kind of, you know, take shortcuts, to not just leave it all out on the field, to use a, you know, sports analogy, you know, that's criticism that would hurt, that would cut, because we needed people to understand, people in this community to understand that we were fighting for justice in this case, that we were going to fight and we were going to fight hard and we were going to fight for every single ounce of evidence that we could put in.
We'll be right back to my interview with Jerry Blackwell and Steve Slisher after this.
Support for this show comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise, an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab, tracks the stories making news right now and breaks them down for the average investor. Host Mike Townsend, Charles Schwab's managing director for legislative and regulatory affairs, takes a nonpartisan look at the stories that matter most to investors. He explores topics like policy initiatives for retirement savings, taxes, and trade, inflation fears, the Federal Reserve, and how regulatory developments can affect companies, sectors, and even the entire market. In every episode, Mike and his guests offer their perspectives on how policy changes could affect what you do with your portfolio. Download the latest episode and follow at schwab.com/WashingtonWise or wherever you listen.
So one of the things that's interesting to me, and I wrote about it in an essay a couple of weeks ago, and you didn't talk about race for the reasons that we discussed, and it's not necessary to prove motive in a case like this, except as I always learned and as I also tried to teach, you know, jurors have some curiosity. They want to know what the theory of why the guy did the thing he did. And unless I missed it, you didn't really address it until much later in the case, in the summation. And in the summation, you said about Mr. Chauvin,
they were pointing cameras at him, recording him, telling him what to do, challenging his authority, his ego, his pride. Not the kind of pride that makes you do better, be better. The kind of ego-based pride. But the defendant was not going to be told what to do. The defendant, he chose pride over policing.
Why was it necessary to make that point, and why wait so long to make that point?
As you said, jurors want to know why somebody did something. They want an explanation. And I believe that, based on the evidence that we introduced, that was a reasonable inference. If you just looked at the look on his face, not only in, you know, what's been referred to as Exhibit 17 over and over in the still photo, but if you watch the bystander video and the way he was interacting with the crowd, and how they were crying out to him over and over, get up off him. He's human. You know, you're hurting him. You're killing him, right? For him not to respond to that, to not attend to the person who is right beneath him, but instead to kind of stare these people down, it seemed to me to be fairly apparent from what we introduced. Now, in terms of introducing that, you know, in an opening statement, for example, that would be argumentative. That would, you know, rightfully draw an objection. You really can't make that, what would be an argument. And in terms of putting...
And you couldn't elicit it from witnesses either, probably.
Right.
That's right.
Right. You can't. It was something that needed to be said, but that was a matter of closing argument.
And taken mostly just circumstantially from both his body language and what could be seen. We did have a ruling also from the court that limited the evidence that could be admitted that characterized state of mind for anyone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that was the other thing to navigate. But we did understand that the jurors were looking for this extra piece to connect the dots. And it might not have been enough, although certainly true, that there are empowered people, at least those who feel they're empowered, who will sometimes mistreat others just because they can.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you all can do about it. I do what I want, as long as I want, to whom I want, and that's what I'm doing. And that's true too. But it was easier to talk about in terms of pride and ego as an explanation for the jurors.
Here's something else I found really interesting, and then also even more interesting when I realized from the things that you two have said in the last couple of weeks that Attorney General Keith Ellison played a substantial role in the trial strategy, and that is witness order. And I was surprised that you began with the bystanders until I saw the testimony unfold. And I guess my question is, if you can answer, was it always the plan to start with these bystanders, or during the course of preparation and preparing these witnesses, did you come to realize just how compelling they were? Because often in a case like this, you might begin with a law enforcement witness who's unlikely to go awry, particularly since you had so many law enforcement witnesses, including the chief, who were able to testify. I'm just, as a former trial lawyer, maybe future again, what the thinking was there?
We discussed it a lot. We talked a lot about witness order and how best to present this. And, it really came back to the bystander video. What is it that touched everyone? You know, what is it that really touched people's hearts and shocked the conscience? It was that bystander video that was shot, that was seen around the world.
But it was really, it was a function, though, of where do we start our story? Do we start it in the 929? Do we start it chronologically at the point he arrives at Cup Foods? And we decided that the main thing for this case is what's happening in the 929. And so let's start with the main thing and keep focused on the main thing. And the best way to be able to characterize that 929, apart from the video we have, would be the eyewitness testimony about what was happening there and the efforts to intervene. And it though started with the idea that we'll start our story with what's happening in the subdual and the restraint on the ground. Mm-hmm. And the bystanders were part of that. Now, at the same time, it would be no surprise, I don't think I'm saying anything out of school, that we would expect that a defense of the case would be focused on the sensitivities that might apply to officers on the scene, to people like Mr. Chauvin. Mm-hmm. And we'll basically talk about the bystanders more or less as objects, mm-hmm. and even Mr. Floyd. And so we knew that there would be a need to humanize all of them, to humanize mm-hmm. these humans. And mm-hmm. and maybe one of the sub-themes, at least sub-thoughts in the case, was being able to just reveal and give to the jurors the fundamental humanity of all the persons who were there. And the premise was that the humanity that unites all of us will be greater than any of these different ideas that divide us. You know, the unruly mob, crazed on drugs, hostile and angry. Mm-hmm. All of those things are kind of cut through once you see the anguish and feel the anguish of the bystanders who are just trying to save a life.
I feel helpless. I don't have a mama either. I understand him.
And Preet, you know, you're starting out with a law enforcement witness, and that's a whole language selection that's going to be imprinted upon the jurors. They'll last throughout the trial. So, for example, you know, if an officer is discussing this event, they're going to exit the vehicle. They're going to approach the, right. the subject.
Right.
So it'll either be a subject or a suspect. It's not a person, you know. It's important to come back, as Jerry said, to the humanity of it, to have people say, we saw a man on the ground being pinned down by others who was hurting and crying out in pain. That's the language that we need to use. And then the rest of it, you know, can be in the context of that, you know, initial reaction.
You talked about the video, and there was a lot of debate in, you know, legal circles, and I had some of this on the podcast too, about how often would you show the video? And I know that you too also, in thinking about the strategy here, you know, worried with the team about the jury becoming desensitized. And something I thought was really remarkable about the video and how you folks used it. And that is, obviously the video as a whole was played at the start, and it's jarring and shocking, and most people hadn't seen it in its entirety. And if they had, it had been close to a year since they'd seen it on cable television. And so people get an immediate impression of a man having his life snuffed out by Officer Chauvin in the video. But then there were little things in the video that you pointed out that maybe were lost. And what I thought was fascinating in hearing you talk about the case in a different forum, and I wonder if you could elaborate, is one of the reasons you thought it was okay to play the video more than a few times was that you individually yourselves kept finding new things that supported the understanding that this was a deliberate and at least indifferent act on the part of Chauvin.
You hear George Floyd saying to Chauvin, my stomach hurts, my neck hurts, everything hurts. And Chauvin not only acknowledging that he hears him, but, you know, just kind of dismissively mocking him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that those are some things that you miss, you know, not only when you see the video once, but recall there are numerous videos here. So we have the bystander video. The microphones are closest to the bystanders, and so you can hear what they're saying and discussing. What we caught on that video you're referring to with the body-worn cameras of the officers. And so you recall that one of the themes of the defense was that the crowd was so distracting that these officers couldn't do their job. But yet you heard them speaking in normal tones, leisurely picking rocks out of the tire tread and responding to
George Floyd when he was expressing that he was hurting. There was a lot in the video, but as to the issue of desensitizing based on playing it, I guess for myself, having watched all of these videos, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, the humanity of it never leaves you. It's something that you cannot become desensitized to. You can become desensitized to a gory scene in a movie. You can become desensitized to that, maybe even a photograph, perhaps. But watching a man die slowly, I don't know how you can become desensitized to it, quite frankly. None of us on the team did. One of the most difficult things in preparing the closing was figuring out how to say the words without becoming emotional. Inappropriately.
Well, that would have been, can I ask a question that people might have? Why would that have been so bad?
You know, I think that as a prosecutor, you owe it to the system to present a case based on the facts and based on the evidence and not some sort of improper, you know, plea to your own emotion. This isn't about me, right? This is about what happened to this man. And, you know, it certainly would not be appropriate, in my view, for me to become overly emotional such that I, you know, were to start to cry.
Can I ask you a question just because it occurred to me? And
sure.
Defense lawyers listening may not like this question. Is it appropriate for defense lawyers to cry in summation?
You know, I don't think so.
Seen it happen.
Sure. Right.
And, there was a defense lawyer that was familiar to our office, cried every summation.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't think, and I do know certain lawyers in the civil context who cry in every trial. They tell the same story in closing, and they cry in it too every time. I wouldn't think that you're required to be something other than human, that you have the normal mm-hmm. human emotions. But a planned stage kind of crying, that kind of emotion, I would be concerned. How do you know where it begins and ends? And you may lose it. Mm-hmm. As the prosecutor or defense lawyer.
Going into the trial, was your greatest concern with respect to a plausible defense from the beginning and during the trial always the causation and the confusion that might be wrought by the medical arguments that the defense was going to be making about the cause of death, or was it something else?
No, that certainly was, to me, hugely of concern. As you know, I focused primarily on the medical case and Steve primarily on use of force. But as the person focused on the medical, I felt at the end of the day, they won't be able to point to any policy or training or anything that permitted Mr. Chauvin to do what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent they have a BOP gun that they were loading up, it's to make all their arguments around medical causation, which is where they really hope to make hay. Out of everything from his high blood pressure, his enlarged heart, the blood vessels, the paraganglioma, you name it. On the one hand, he was this human being that had superhuman strength, the power of John Henry. And then on the other hand, he was a ticking time bomb who was about to fall apart at any second. And would argue either one of those, depending on what suited the moment. So that to me was a real concern. The video played obviously prominently in the medical causation case because it either ruled in certain things or ruled them out based on what you could see on the video, that there are certain things. I talked a lot about, for example, the anoxic seizures that are a result of low oxygen in the brain, an involuntary reflex that you can see in the video that we can point to. We can point it out, which is not the sort of thing you would see if you didn't know what an anoxic seizure is or where it manifests. But the direct answer to your question was, yes, we were concerned about the medical causation case, whether it is his comorbidities that is in his own body and or their focus on his history of drug addiction and drug use.
A huge issue in the case related to causation was what the standard is. And there was a competing view as to what you had to prove to show that Mr. Chauvin was guilty of the crimes with which he was charged. Can you just recite again what the judge was going to tell the jury they had to find with respect to causation?
Well, it was actually, it shouldn't have been a matter of competing views since it was in the jury instructions.
Well, yeah. Well, I guess the defense had a different request.
Well,
jury instruction.
That's true, but the standard was that we had to prove that Mr. Chauvin's conduct was a substantial factor.
Right, not the exclusive factor, but a substantial factor.
A substantial factor, not even necessarily the greatest one. That there can be any number of substantial factors.
Right. So this is a question I've been dying to ask you guys, and I never knew if I would ever have the opportunity. And this may be a geeky, nerdy, lawyer tactical question. But there came a moment, and I'm sitting in the basement of my home where I record this podcast, and I also watched the trial, and the defense counsel completely and totally misstated the law with respect to causation. And I looked up at the screen, and I was expecting, one of you guys to jump up and object. And then I had a debate with a few of my former colleagues about the propriety of objecting during summations and can it ever be done? And is it better to deal with it on rebuttal? So I'm dying to know how you thought about that, because you did obviously robustly object later. And I think you may have even asked for a curative instruction. What was the thinking in your mind when the defense lawyer said that thing that completely misstated what the judge had said earlier in terms of the law to the jury?
It was, at least in my mind, and that would have been my call at the time, was what would be the best way, what would be the best approach for getting this clarified and corrected before the jury? If I object here in the middle of his closing, I might be more apt to get a summary overruled from the judge. It may have been fueled by the fact that I'm objecting during the closing, for all I know. And when there is a break, when there's a chance to have a thoughtful exchange with the court, we're much more likely to get an instruction that gets the information in front of the jury and get it corrected. And so I opted for waiting until we got to the break to get in front of the judge to raise the issue and to see if the judge would give, would cure it. And given what we were told by the court, I was frankly pleased we hadn't objected, because he just basically said, well, your turn is next. And so you can get up and explain this to the jury. So I didn't know at the time how the court would react to it. And I felt that our better shot was to try to get it corrected when we had a chance to have a thoughtful exchange with the court that wasn't likely to happen right in the middle of the closing. And ultimately, when he said, you can address it in your rebuttal, then I thought, well, just fine.
And Preet, also, as you know, with a jury, they really do depend on us. They expect us to be straight with them, and your credibility with them is just, it's so important. And if you have a situation where your opposing counsel says something that just is, it's an incorrect statement of law, it's different than what the judge said, I think they do that at their peril. I think that the jurors then see, well, gosh, this attorney said this, but that's not what the judge said. And they do tend to defer to the judge. And so, I certainly had a visceral reaction to it as well. But I did think to myself, as with Jerry, it's like, well, that's not going to be something that they're going to be glad they said.
As lawyers in the process, and obviously a defense lawyer has to prove his case and has to represent his client zealously. But do you have a theory as to why he misstated the law? I didn't see any sort of mistake there. I don't think that was carelessness.
I've been in front of judges who would go absolutely crazy if some lawyer stood up and misstated the law.
Judge Mukasey, I've said this before, who later became the attorney general, if you tried a case in front of him, if that defense lawyer said that thing in front of Judge Mukasey, you would have heard him say, sustained, even though there had been no objection.
Right. Yeah, I have something that the floor would open up and you would fall in a hole to do that. I wasn't sure exactly how this would play out there in the closing. And I thought if we had a shot at getting it corrected, it would be when we had a chance to have a real thoughtful discussion with the court. Then on the other hand, well, if he says, I'll leave it up to your argument, then, well, that's not all bad either. to kind of start off with a rebuttal that what you heard isn't telling to you straight. I mean, with an argument that starts with, look at the totality of the circumstances and look at it honestly, truthfully, and it begins with misstating the standard. I mean, that's a non-starter.
What was the feeling in the courtroom, the mood, the tone, the tenor? Were there actually light moments? Was it always very heavy? And then how did that change, if at all, when you found out there was a verdict?
So there were some light moments. I mean, it was generally pretty somber, you know, all the time. We had a job to do, very serious. But, you know, it was certainly, there was, we were collegial, polite to each other. You know, I can't think of any specific light moment, but it wasn't as contentious as one right. might imagine. Both parties were very focused on doing their job. And, you know, on the prosecution side, we, of course, you know, sole burden of proof, coordinating a lot of witnesses and evidence. And, you know, we were just very, very focused. I made the remark that, I mean, there could have been hailing a Pentecostal fire outside of the courtroom, and I wouldn't have noticed at all because we were just so locked in. A personality trait that's been pointed out to me maybe isn't as charming as one might imagine, too, when you get into trial mode.
And, you know, Judge Cahill was very much in command of his courtroom. Mm-hmm. There was a high degree of professionalism between the lawyers, the parties, and the jurors were very attentive. They took, you know, lots of notes. They paid attention. Rarely saw anybody dozing off. On the jury, but I wouldn't describe there being kind of very many moments of levity mm-hmm. during the trial. I mean, it's hard when every day you're watching a person mm-hmm. Die every day.
Yeah, and there were a lot of tears on occasion from the witnesses for good reason.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So then you hear there's a verdict fairly quickly, during which time, during the deliberations that had taken place up to that time, did not produce any questions from the jury. And I got texts from members of the press and others about what I thought that meant. And every instinct I had suggested, given the way that you put the case in, the strength of the case, the speed of the verdict indicated to me that it was a guilty verdict, except, and I've heard people say this, you couldn't expect or say that because in other cases like this involving these dynamics, that has often not been the result. How did you think about it in that longest hour you had to wait before the verdict?
I think you just said it. Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean?
Like as a trial lawyer, you knew, but as a person in America, you were not sure.
That's absolutely right. There are a few disappointments greater than the anticipation of a positive verdict and you're sure of it. And the jury comes in and you get the greatest gut punch of your life mm-hmm. when they've decided something different. I didn't know how they could. They had been out so little time, in my view, that they didn't really have time to argue about a great deal. So this all seems to look good for the prosecution. But these cases are tough cases. And so it was that was an agonizing, particularly the last 30 minutes of it sitting there.
The last 30 minutes was, that was terrible. I remember, coming to the courthouse, and I was thinking the same thing. I was just logically thinking to myself, they didn't have any questions. They didn't ask to review any evidence. They haven't been out that long. And so that suggested to me that this was going to be a verdict that we were happy with. But, you know, when you get to the last portion of it, of course, what you do is you spend every nanosecond second-guessing every word you uttered over the last month.
Is just, that your drill? Your drill is to replay the trial in your head at that moment.
It's the worst part, as you know, right?
Jerry, do you have a better drill than that?
I do have a better drill. I sit at the table and I answer random emails, which is what I was doing.
How are you capable of doing, that's not a better drill. That's ridiculous. How are you able to do that?
Meditation, Preet. Helps me to focus. And so I thought just to sit here looking at the wall, staring at the people, feeling all the stray voltage. Well, here's at least something constructive I can do. I can answer these emails while I'm sitting here.
Do you brace yourself? Because I remember hearing that in my first trial ever as a younger person, to brace yourself and to have no emotional response at all, no matter what the verdict is. Do you think about that and do you steel yourself to whatever the verdict is, even if it's one that you want and would be gratified to get?
Absolutely. Yeah. This is somebody's life. This isn't a victory in that sense. It's an acknowledgement of the truth of what happened. But it's not a cause for celebration. And so you just think of the weight of it. You're aware of the fact that the family of George Floyd is watching.
Filonis was sitting behind us, and you feel that, and you're thinking to yourself, is this going to be a situation where we have to compose ourselves and come back and comfort them? Yeah, all of that runs through your head.
And for me, it was a little bit different, because when all is said and done, I mean, I got involved in this matter as, for me, a spiritual cause. And my duty was to give it my best and my utmost, but to kind of work hard at not being attached to the results in the same way that this, the battle, the struggle, the fact that the nation has to itself wrestle with this, the world is wrestling with this, is its own form of progress in a way. And while, don't get me wrong, I mean, we certainly did want the guilty verdicts, but I really had kind of fixed in my mind that my duty really was to serve and to give it my absolute best, and I felt I had done that. And if they came back a different way, then I still would think that there's been a benefit from this trial. Just to have to wrestle with it this way, and it moved us in some ways further down the track towards something that looks like a reconciliation, even though it wasn't just yet. It's mounting the pressure for we still have to deal with these issues. And it's even not even clear case that we have to deal with these issues if it were an adverse verdict. So I was sort of prepared that, as I say in meditation, you know, do your best and give it to God. And that's how I felt about it.
There's a legal question that I've gotten from a number of listeners. And that is, how can it be the case that the jury could come back and convict on all three counts, murder two, murder three, and manslaughter, when the mental states required to prove each of those is different? In other words, people are confused about how they could find guilt on all counts when it seems like you're talking about different kinds of crimes, not just lesser included, but sort of different mental states. Does that make sense as a question? And does one of you want to answer it?
Well, you know, what I can say is that I think that these, when you look at the elements of what is required for each of the different charges, you see very different things. And the murder two charge, it's a felony murder. It's unintentional felony murder. I've described this before as kind of a Rube Goldberg, you know, those machines where you roll the ball and it hits a pin knocks it, right? And so it's kind of like that. I mean, what we had to prove was that there was a felony level assault, an intentional felony level assault, and that during the commission of that assault, that the defendant caused George Floyd's death. And so the required mental state there was, you know, intentional conduct that was an assault. It wasn't an accident that he found himself kneeling on George Floyd's neck. It was that he did some volitional act, which in fact was a felony level assault that caused the death. That's not at odds with the commission of an imminently dangerous act, the placing yourself on the neck and back of George Floyd for that extended period of time, given what law enforcement knows and has known for at least 30 years about the dangers of positional asphyxia, right? A trained, known risk to do that for that extended period of time certainly was an eminently dangerous act. And so the mental state there is that, you know, the defendant knew of this risk and took it, notwithstanding the potential consequences. And then with our second degree manslaughter, it's kind of a variation of the same thing. You know, manslaughter is sort of a negligence-based offense. And so with that is not only his actions, but his willful inactions, his failures to act, his failure to provide medical attention, for example, despite the training and knowledge and the affirmative obligation to do so. And so these charges were similar in causation and whatnot, and you saw that in the closing, how many of these elements sort of merged into each other. But
they weren't mutually exclusive.
They were not exclusive, and to prove one is not to disprove the other. And that's why, you know, the convictions of all three counts.
Did either of you or both of you spend time with George Floyd's family after the verdict?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
We
can you describe what their reaction was?
It was tearful. It was jubilant. You could feel this, what felt like a giant sort of exhalation from the family, given the pressure that they were under, the tension they felt about whether there would be any justice for their brother, whether there would be some indication that at least his life mattered. And so to have been there in the room with them, with the hugs and the tears, starting in the courtroom, actually, with the Filonis.
Yeah.
It was a powerful moment with the family, with their sense that that there had been, at least been, you know, justice or at least accountability.
I think, you know, just as speaking of the family, I say that the family was remarkable. I want to put that in a little bit of context. You know, in over 2 decades of prosecuting experience and certainly having to spend a lot of time, unfortunately, with people who've lost loved ones to violence, a lot of people in that position, just they don't have anything to give, right? Because they've lost so much and they are themselves so lost and it's difficult. The Floyd family was so giving of themselves, just sending words of encouragement, telling us that we were doing a good job all the time. And just to be able to do that in a situation where they lost George Floyd, they lost their loved one, but they always made time for us. They always took the time to specifically address each of us. If they thought that we had a good day in court, they would say that. As an advocate, you find that so energizing. It just gives you oxygen. It gives you something to fight for. And I just thought that was remarkable that they were so giving of themselves in that way.
Yeah, I mean, what could be tougher than that? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Were you in a position to see the defendant, Derek Chauvin's reaction? Because sometimes, depending on how the court is configured, the prosecutors cannot.
No, we could. He was...
What's your observation about that?
His demeanor didn't change one bit. It was very stoic. No visible emotions of any kind. Even when he was asked to turn around for them to put the handcuffs on, there wasn't any emoting of any kind that I saw.
Do you think he was expecting that you would move to remand him?
Yes, I would think so. I mean, I think
you'd think his lawyers would have told him that, right? I'm not sure the public appreciated that.
Yeah, I think he would know that that's pretty much the drill.
Now, see, I know you've been asked this question before about what would have happened had Derek Chauvin testified, and I think you were on deck to do the cross, and I don't think you would answer the question as to what the themes or thrust of your cross would be, but let me ask you this question. How long do you think that cross-examination would have been after he testified on direct?
That's hard to say. You know, you prepare yourself for every possible contingency, but the length of a cross examination is something that just sort of happens, right? There's not a prescribed time for it to come out of the oven, but you kind of get a sense of when it's done. And so I really don't know. It would have taken as long as it would have taken to go through every moment of that restraint, of the 929, I think that you would expect a cross-examination of this to be about what the case was about. And that was the restraint on the ground from the start to the finish and asking for justification for all of it. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how long it would have taken. It's something that you feel when you're in the moment.
What's the proper sentence for Derek Chauvin?
Well, it's what Judge Cahill decides is fair, and I think the answer.
I'm
laughing because you know how we can answer that question.
I know, but I had to ask the question. So, Jerry, you know, one thing that people commented on with respect to not just you and Steve, but everyone on the government side, and we've talked about this during this interview, right? The government is supposed to be, you know, the sober, non-emotional, you know, non-fancy provider of information and elicitor of facts above the fray. And I think all of that is true. And very rarely should you, and in this case didn't, engage in flourish. That might not be the right word for the question I'm about to ask. But boy, at the end of your rebuttal summation, you had a zinger. And again, that's not the right word either. It was a very powerful short statement, but it stood apart from the way that all of you talked about the case and the facts and the evidence before that point, I think. And here's what you said.
You were told, for example, that Mr. Floyd died because his heart was too big. You heard that testimony. And now, having seen all the evidence, having heard all the evidence, you know the truth. And the truth of the matter is that the reason George Floyd is dead is because Mr. Chauvin's heart was too small.
Boy, that's a devastating way to end a rebuttal summation. Why'd you say that? And why was it important to say it in that kind of way?
I wanted to bring it back for jurors to what they felt in their heart of hearts about what is fundamentally wrong with what happened here. I tend to believe that people make their decisions first and foremost on what I call an emotional level based on their own sense of what's right and wrong.
But you didn't do that along the way, right?
That's right.
What's fascinating about it to me, and the brilliance of it to me at least, is you didn't overdo it. You did it there, and you did it at the end. It was almost like the way you would end, and I mean this as a compliment, because most movie summation writing, separate from getting the law wrong, is better than most real life summation writing. But it's kind of the way that the scene should have ended. If you had been writing this for the screen, about an incident like this that is so, you know, torn apart the country, that's the line you would have written.
You know, I wanted the jurors to go away with the final thought being one that says, that's absolutely right. That's right. That if he had the heart that was the size of a 9-year-old girl, George Floyd would still be alive. And it just seemed to capture it all. You know, I was very cognizant of the fact that not only are we prosecutors, but we're prosecutors in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And Minnesotans, you know, are a wonderful people. So let me just say that. But they're not a wonderfully emotive people, okay? So, and that as one kind of older friend of mine who's in her 90s, German Lutheran Minnesotan, she kind of made the comment that here we don't smile for no reason because showing teeth is a sign of aggression. And, you know, and so if you in Minnesota, if you have too much of the motive stuff, if it's too early on in the case, you risk turning off some Minnesota mm-hmm. jurors in doing that. But I did want to get to the heart to as sort of the punchline. If you distilled and boiled everything down to the fundamental narrative, what happened here was simply that an officer did not care enough. And when all is said and done, he had a duty to care. He was trained in how to provide care, and he needed to put the care back into, in your custody is in your care. And that to me was the bottom line that plays out through all the counts and the charges and the evidence and the experts is fundamentally, he just didn't care.
And the brilliance of it, Preet, was that it was conduct and causation in a single statement.
Right.
It was beautiful and lyrical. And as an advocate, it was something that I admired and enjoyed watching and hearing very, very much.
When did you come up with that statement?
Wow, I'm just kind of thinking about when it was. It wasn't on the spot, I'll tell you that. But mm-hmm.
did it come to you the night before as a revelation?
It came a few days before as sort of a revelation when I was thinking about all the arguments about his comorbidities, you know, the size of his heart and so on. And I thought, well, that's a lot of nerve. Mm-hmm. Focus on the size of his heart. And right, I said, I get it.
That's a lot of nerve, focusing on the size of his heart.
Right.
Exactly right. Well, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you for your service. I understand that you may be listeners of the podcast, so I'm honored by that as well.
We are.
We are.
Yes, and thank
you. That's why the case went so well.
We learned it all from you.
It's
from listening
because
to your
of me.
Podcast.
It's because of me.
I was wondering when we were going to get to that.
Yeah, exactly. So modest
Not
of you
till,
to wait to bring it up till now.
I too have served the country in an indirect way. Were you both, you know, when, you know, we put the request out, I wanted to talk to you folks, was thrilled when we got the quick reply that you would come on. You know, I could spend 3 hours with you talking about the case, the impact of the case. And I guess let me just end with that. Although it goes beyond the task you had as lawyers in this case, but you're also Americans who care about the issue, as we started with. Final question, you know, what do you think this means and where do we go from here in the country on the issues that have been raised by the conduct of Mr. Chauvin?
For me, Preet, it's a recognition of the need for human empathy and compassion. I don't know what it means in terms of the larger issues going forward with policing and police reform and whatnot. I'm not a policymaker, and I guess I leave those decisions to policymakers. I do think that just sort of as a country, as a people, we need to recognize each other's humanity more and to have empathy for each other more and not just simply decide, you know, whoever is saying what's being said, to decide what side you're on, ignore all evidence to the contrary, and only listen to that supports your preconceived position. You know, for me, it means a lot of that. And just even seeing the way people would treat folks who had testified in the trial. You see different tweets and things that people say, disparaging people, disparaging certain witnesses, disparaging anyone. And you're just kind of amazed by it, thinking to yourself, you know, would these people say this to each other's face? Is it okay to be saying things like this online? To just sort of, other examples of disregarding each other's humanity. And I hope that this is something that people can recognize and see that when, you know, what are the perils? What happens when we do that? When the person who we're there to protect and serve is not a person, but a super person or mm-hmm. superhuman. Where does that end? What does that cause us to do?
And Preet, I agree with Steve.
We, Jerry and I didn't know each other coming into this. We began to see each other as lawyers who love to try cases, who fight hard and who like to win cases. I come away with this from this experience with a friend, with mm-hmm. a new friend. And that's something that I've gained. I say in public service, if you do public service, you get more than you give. And I certainly have received more than I've given in having the privilege of trying this case.
Likewise. And if nothing else, I would like to encourage other private practitioners on the civil side to think about ways that you too can step into similar shoes to be of use in similar cases. And you don't have to know every aspect of criminal law, but there are things that we learn in complex civil that are useful in a case of this sort.
Great message to end on. Jerry Blackwell and Steve Slisher, thank you for your service. Thank you for doing what you do. Thank you for being on the show.
No, Preet, we really, really enjoyed it. So
thank you.
Very much so.
Well, that's it for this episode of Stay Tuned. Thanks again to my guests, Jerry Blackwell and Steve Slisher.
If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet, or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to staytuned@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your host is Preet Bharara. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Jennifer Korn, Chris Boylan, and Sean Walsh. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.